Pensacola's first choice for morning news, traffic, sports, and talk. The Pensacola Morning News with Andrew McKay. News Radio 92.3 AM 1620. Good morning, Pensacola.
Overnight, the first known military action under Commander-in-Chief Joe Biden against an Iranian-backed target in Syria. Retaliation, we're told, for recent attempted attacks targeting U.S. troops.
Right, so the White House says that these strikes overnight, as you mentioned, President Biden's first as president, were in response to attacks on U.S. personnel and U.S. targets earlier this month. So early this month, we know that one U.S. civilian contractor was killed and six others wounded in rocket attacks in northern Iraq on Erbil.
Yeah, so this was the news overnight. Of course, this attack that took place at like a border crossing, basically, which we, you know, the intelligence believes, or according to General Lloyd Austin, now the Secretary of Defense, is connected with the rocket attacks that have taken place inside of Iraq. The as you heard there, that, you know, had taken the life of one military contractor, wounded others, and you have to describe this, I think, as a proportional response. And in fact, it was kind of a, there's a whole bunch of, and also this kind of things about this. One, it's obviously the first military endeavor by President Joe Biden. Number two, it happened on the same day as he was having his first call with the leader of Saudi Arabia. And, of course, the U.S. has historically been with Saudi Arabia and very much against Iran. Syria is a proxy for Iran, as you should know, but if you don't, you know, you can't, you don't know what you don't know. So this is, you know, is an anti-Iran via Syria, because of the attack in Iraq. And so taking the day and being with the Saudi leader, and then also taking a stance against Iran on the same day, is a signal. It's a proportional signal, meaning it's not an overwhelming response, which is an indication that the Biden administration isn't eager to escalate. But it's definitely a signal that says, you know, you just can't send rockets this way. And of course, this surely by the Iranians and their proxies in Syria was a test of American will and resolve under the new administration. Because under Trump, there was never any doubt that there would be a response of some kind. There was also never any doubt that we were very much aligned with the Saudis and very much aligned against the Iranians, something that has been, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in the new administration. I mean, it took him weeks before he even spoke with the prime minister of Israel, which is not an encouraging sign for those of us who think that Israel is our best ally in the Middle East and the key example of democracy in the Middle East. But nevertheless, here we are. And the question then is, you know, well, how sure are we? What intelligence went into this? You know, was it the right response? Was it an appropriate response on a plane overnight? Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense, talked with the press for at least a minute.
We're confident that that target was being used by the same Shia militia that that conducted the strikes. We allowed and encouraged the Iraqis to investigate and develop intelligence, and that was very helpful to us and refining the target.
So does this mean that we are on the road to escalation in Syria? Well, I would say the administration's answer, not to speak for them, but I am sure their answer would be, we hope not. The Russians have come out against this attack, but that's because they have been involved in the Syrian conflict for, you know, as long as it has been. We'd been out of there, but now, not yet in, obviously, certainly not with boots on the ground or anything like that, but this is a statement. This is a statement that you cannot attack us in Iraq. This is a statement that Iran, we will push back, even though we know it's from you, we will push back, but we will push back in a limited fashion, not in a overwhelming, you know, force show, no massive deterrence, no escalation. So as with many things, time will tell whether this is effective or not. 437-1620, 437-1620. Lots of other stuff to get to overnight, including this is kind of an interesting one. Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio has now reintroduced a bill, and I am generally all in favor of educational reform, pretty much any shape that it takes. I think the education system in this country is just, it's, and I taught, you know, for 10 years as a college professor, so I'm not exposed heavily to every layer of it from personal experience other than having been a public school student, but generally speaking, our education system is not set up well. Let me just put it that way. One of the big problems is competition. Obviously, if you believe in markets, you believe in competition, you believe in the best product at the lowest price is a byproduct of competition, and having, you know, only one platform, a monopoly delivering any product is never going to be your best recipe for success. So he has sponsored the Educational Opportunities Act. And this would allow qualified scholarship granting organizations. This is entities that grant vouchers, if you want to think of it. Vouchers is kind of the old term, but scholarships, needs-based scholarships to students to defray the cost of attending private as in non-public schools. And this bill creates an individual federal tax credit up to $4,500, corporate tax credit of up to $100,000 for donations. So what this is incentivizing people like you and me or a business to donate to any fund that is going to turn around and issue scholarships or vouchers to non-public schools, private schools, or charter schools. Well, I guess charters don't cost. Anyway, to private schools that charge a fee to allow parents to put their kids in the school that they want to put them in. I'm always fascinated, sort of fascinated as a, you know, I taught logic and that's not, but fascinated by the argument that defenders of the public school system make that you're now destroying the system, that it's not fair to the system, that it's undermining the system, that it's taking money away from the system. It's definitely taking money away in the sense that if you can incentivize a student to go here rather than there, and you don't get paid anymore on the basis of that student, but obviously you have costs incurred on the basis of the number of students you have. So it's not essentially harming that system, but even so, that's just the wrong way to look at it. The real question is, who should be in charge of deciding what sort of education a child gets? Should it be some governmental institution? Should it be a teacher's union? Or should it be the parents? And if you have, and again, remember, this is targeted towards low-income parents. If you have, and we do a lot of this here in Florida. We're actually one of the leaders in the country at you know, allowing parents to choose the educational platform that their children, they think would be best for them. So if you have parents who do not have the resources to put their kids in the kind of school they would prefer, which is often because they have the worst school systems and they're trying to leave them, if they don't have money, then basically what you're saying is not only do you have to suffer poverty, but your children will not get the best advantages because you can't help them educate themselves out of poverty. Whereas something like a voucher or a scholarship program is a way of saying, you know what? The ability of a child to get a good education shouldn't depend on whether their parents have money or not. And we're going to let you choose because you're in the best position. See, if the parents think the education is better, then we ought to be doing as much as we can to facilitate that belief. And the idea that somehow this is a betrayal of some grand system organized by the government to give you the benefit that they think you should prefer as opposed to the benefit that you actually want. You see the problem? 517 here on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. To be clear, I am in favor of the good teachers. I'm in favor of, I mean, obviously, having good education is a major value. In fact, it's probably my primary value when I think about politics is making sure that the education system or that the educational results are good. So I often find myself, you know, in favor of good teachers in good schools. And certainly we talk with our public educators all the time. But at the same time, philosophically, I believe in homeschooling. We homeschool. I believe in private school. You know, if I'll be honest, we probably would have sent, we would have, at least would have more seriously considered sending kids to private school if we, you know, if it weren't for the money of it. And that's the way it ought to be. You shouldn't have to buy, you know, you shouldn't have to take the government car because it's free, even though you wish you could take the more expensive car that actually works really well, that you believe works better. This is not, it's not even American. Might be traditional, but that's not really within the concept of free markets and choice and freedom and opportunity. So, yeah, the very notion of having one big platform that the government provides, that the government knows best, that then the entities within that system are going to actively prevent competition, that is fundamentally not American. or free market or freedom based. And that's why I have that problem when it shows up at that sort of, you know, meta level. 518 News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. I'm Andrew McKay. Morning, 5:21 here on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. I'm Andrew McKay. It's a Pensacola Morning News. Mark Jacobs is in the newsroom with our headlines. Mark?
Overnight, the Pentagon confirming that U.S. strike on Iran-backed militia in Syria. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin explaining they chose the targets carefully.
We're very deliberate about our approach, as you would expect us to be. We allowed and encouraged the Iraqis to investigate and develop intelligence, and that was very helpful to us and refining a target.
President Biden ordering that strike in eastern Syria following a series of rocket attacks against U.S. forces in Iraq. The House set to vote today on the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package. The stimulus bill aimed at delivering quick relief to Americans, including that another round of stimulus checks. And there I am.
That was so weird.
Where'd you go, Mark?
I don't know. All of a sudden, I just disappeared.
Back.
We were talking about going to the thrift shops and such and making discoveries yesterday. Well, an item that went for $35 at a garage sale in Connecticut could bring its new owner $500,000.
Ooh.
Sotheby's and says the small blue and white floral bowl, you know, you saw that at a garage sale, thought, oh, nice, $35. Well, it's actually a piece of China's history from the 15th century.
Oh, my.
And it hits the auction block next month.
$35 is far more
than I would ever spend for
a little decorative bowl at a garage sale. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I pass up.
Right. That is pretty expensive. That's like $10 at most.
$35 is what you pay when you're like, oh, man, I think this is Chinese history.
Well, it depends on what neighborhood in Connecticut this garage sale was.
Sure. In some neighborhoods, that's just they're putting potting plants in it, right?
I'm also thinking about the family sitting there watching the news.
Oh,
I recognize that bowl.
Didn't we sell one of those recently?
Oh, wait, my God.
If only there were TV shows where you could take your items and stuff and find out what they're worth. If only there were, you know,
something on maybe public broadcasting.
Right, exactly.
Oh, gee.
I do feel bad for them, though. I mean, you know, you missed out on all that money.
It's probably why somebody paid $35.
Exactly. They saw it and thought, somebody knew.
I think that's more than a $2 item.
Yeah, exactly. But that is definitely a small ceramic decorative bowl. That's the kind of stuff that we are drive-by garage sellers. Mm-hmm. So we'll go to, you know, neighborhood sales are the way to go because then you really maximize your effect. You know, 20 homes in a neighborhood. And we will slowly drive by and see if it's even worth stopping. We're not like go to every one kind of folks.
Oh, no.
And when I see, it's like, oh, that's a, okay, so that's new. We're not going to that one.
You might want to be a little more adventurous.
Widen our scope a little bit.
Widen your scope a little.
Yeah, but then I'd wind up with 1,000 worthless blue bowls, you know?
That's true.
And that's not going to help anybody.
And you can have a garage sale.
All right, Mark, thanks for the update. 524 here on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Oh, one small note. You heard it maybe at the top of the hour, Fox News, and if you didn't, it's important. The reconciliation has been one of these political buzzwords in the last couple of weeks that if you don't know what that's all about, that's okay. Reconciliation is the process whereby the House and the Senate reconciliation, where they reconcile different versions of bills that each chamber passes. And with the, you know, the $1 trillion, $900 billion dollar package that the House is going to vote on today, they're going to include the minimum wage hike to $15 an hour in it. Well, the difficulty is that in the Senate, there are not 60 votes to put this in, most likely. But the talk has been that Bernie Sanders, as the budget chair over in the Senate, that he would nevertheless include or make it so that in reconciliation, it would be added. Because you can do negotiating in reconciliation. You can add and change things in order to get the bills to be the same. But The only hiccup is, would you be able to get legally that added? Is it something that's not budget? Is it too significant? There's a bunch of different rules for this. And so there is a gatekeeper for whether reconciliation can have something like that. It's called the parliamentarian. The parliamentarian is, if you remember the impeachment hearings, you know, when Patrick Leahy would look over and kind of ask somebody what to do and they would tell him, that's the parliamentarian running things, telling him what he can and can't do, what he should and shouldn't say, and so forth. That's their job. Their job is to make sure the rules are all followed. Well, in this case, it happens to be a female, and the report is that she is going to say, or has said, no, you cannot include the $15 minimum wage as an item in reconciliation that has to be actually passed by the Senate in order to be included in the bill. So that's a setback for the White House and the Democrats. That may be the only thing keeping us from implementing a national $15 an hour minimum wage. Now it has to get an actual support in an actual majority vote in support. Again, take 60 to, you know, invoke cloture to stop debate. They could filibuster it. There's several Democrats say they don't like the idea. Of course, many Republicans, most Republicans are against it. So we'll see what happens. But at the moment, the $15 minimum wage hike looks to be out from the bill, but we'll see. 527 on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. You know, Frontier Motors, serving the Pensacola area for more than 25 years. What do they specialize in? It's very simple. You know, they don't specialize in old used cars, and they don't specialize in brand new cars. They're right in between. A car that is 1, 2, 3 years old. Cars that people drive, you know, and then they upgrade, or they, you know, replace with a new, or they got a corporate lease, or, the, you know, 12 months into a new car, 12 months into a new car, that kind of thing. Those are the cars that they acquire because they're in great shape. Then when you buy it, you don't have to take the depreciation hit driving it off the lot. You get to save that. And you have a really high quality car that you can then drive for as long as you want at a good price with a large selection so that you can really pick and choose among the different ones. That's what Frontier Motors specializes in, giving you great, almost new cars. Frontier Motors, serving Pensacola for more than 25 years, behind that big buffalo on Beverly Parkway. Be sure to tell them Andrew McKay says hi. This might be your thing. Are you an Xbox player? You play Xbox?
I'm a PlayStation guy myself.
Okay. So my 12-year-old has an Xbox, and you know, the different platforms for all the different kids, basically. The 12-year-old has an Xbox, and I swear, I could not make this up. The day before yesterday, okay, he buys the, and he goes off and on this, he buys the monthly pass thing. And then yesterday he comes running to me, Dad, the Xbox won't log in. And sure enough, I go look. Worldwide outage. You cannot log into Xbox anywhere in the world yesterday. I don't even know if it's up now. But I just thought, man, that's a bummer for you. It's not our internet or anything like that. It's just they're not available. First time it's happened in a while. So, yay.
You know more because you get your news on News Radio 92.3 AM 1620.
Here on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. A little foggy out, so just be, you know, a little bit cautious and drive with care. You know, don't run around too fast and pay attention. You know, the basic things you do when it's foggy out. Yesterday, we had a chance to talk to Mike Wood. He is the Public Information Officer for the Pensacola Police Department. Mike, welcome back to the show, sir.
Good morning.
Hey, good to have you. And first, before we get started on other stuff, is there anything, any incidents or events that have happened the last day or two that we don't already know about?
No, sir. It's been quiet.
Well, I'll take it. I will always take that. Now, we did have a bit of an unsettling discovery the other day over on the east side of town in the water. Some folks were out at the park and they discovered a body in the water, which I guess we have now identified, but we're still looking for more information about how she got there. Is that right?
Yes, we do know that it was a 61-year-old female, but we're waiting on autopsy results to come back. To find out exactly what caused the death.
Okay. And this was, I have in my head that it was at Bay Bluffs, but it was at Bay Bluffs Chimney Park. Where was it at?
It was near Manalay, off Scenic Highway down on the beach.
Okay, okay.
All right. That's a little bit north of where you're talking about.
Okay, very. I mean, I imagine the folks who discovered it, very unsettling. You know, I just, because we always go down there with Ocean Hour to clean up the beach and just to, you know, be walking along and to find, I mean, obviously it's a sad thing to have her pass away, but distressing to find it as well, right?
Yeah, it is. It's something that you don't ever want to see, but... fortunately somebody found her as quick as they did, for her sake and for that of the family.
Absolutely. Turning out of statewide news, the attorney general, yesterday put forward the notion that, would raise the payout for information leading to a murder case being closed, almost doubling the amount of money. I think it was from $5,000 to $9,500. I'm going to memory ahead in my notes, but I think that's the right amount. You work very closely, like with Crime Stoppers, so you're pretty well familiar with all of this stuff. Is that something, like, are we having the need to incentivize it more, and do you think that would make a difference?
I don't know. We're going to have to wait and see. The higher you can go on the reward, the better, always. Ms. Moody came to our conference last week in Tallahassee and spoke to us about that, about what her plans were, and increasing it can never hurt anything. But what we want, our biggest problem in Crime Stoppers sometimes is the fact that people wait with information thinking that the reward will go up, where Crime Stoppers, our bylaws, that's not allowed. We pay the same for every crime throughout the state, and it's done on a point system. And for somebody to think, well, I've got this information, I know it's good, I'm just going to wait and see how big that reward gets, they're wasting time doing that. So we want to make sure that people know that the faster you call, I mean, you're going to make more money. If you hold that information, that's not going to help you out at all. You're going to get the same amount.
What happens if – so now I have 1,000 questions that I'm curious about. Is it a total amount of money assigned per the criminal event that then gets divvied up among, like, if multiple people come forward with information? I imagine some tips are crucial. Some tips are a little bit helpful. How does that all work out in the payoffs?
It's the first person that calls gets that reward. Now, sometimes we'll have two people call, they both have good information, and they both have pieces of the puzzle that we needed. And in that case, we can pay a reward to each of them.
And it's of the full amount, or do they split it, like, because it's only so much per crime?
That it will be split.
Okay. Okay. So there's a system, and basically first good tip gets the reward, and then if there happens to be an odd situation where it justifies it, you might split it. But generally speaking, you're trying to incentivize people to come forward with their big information quickly, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, Andrew, sometimes there's confusion. Private people can make rewards of their own, and they can make that as high as they want and pay whatever they want for that crime. But Crime Stoppers has to keep that separated. To make sure there's no confusion there. We have a certain amount that we pay for a homicide. It's the same throughout the state. And we have another amount that we pay for maybe a burglary of a car, and it's paid the same throughout the state. So we have to stick to that in order to make sure everybody, the rewards are paid out equally and fairly.
And by the way, just because, we are talking about it, let's make sure that we remind people that when they call Crime Stoppers, that is, it's not just that it is totally anonymous, it's that it has to be anonymous. In other words, if somehow you inform them of your identity, you actually become ineligible to receive the money, right?
That is correct. We can no longer, we can speak to you and we can take the information, but you are no longer able to get a reward at that point because we have to keep you anonymous. That's what the program's all about. And people have messed up before and given that information and didn't even realize what they said. And it's awful hard to explain to them that they're not going to be able to get a reward, but we can still take the information.
But again, that's to protect people's anonymity and the program itself being able to have that reputation of, we will not ask you, and there will be no need to give any. In fact, you can't give it for that exact reason. We're talking to Mike Wood. He is the public information officer for the Pensacola Police Department. I know you and I often talk about the Citizens Police Advisory Committee and some of the questions that come up from that. One of the questions is this idea that if the SWAT team is going to be deployed due to some incident, that the response is going to be more robust or less robust based on where they're going, neighborhoods. And so people perceive a higher militarized response because they live in a poor or maybe a black area. But how does that actually work? Is it always the same? Is it proportional to the neighborhood? Is there any truth to that allegation?
No, not at all. The SWAT teams have protocols that they use. and we respond based on the information that we have. If a person has a warrant and no history of violent behavior, no history of firearms or no information of firearms, you respond one way. But I can promise you that if we know that that person has firearms, they're willing to use them, we will respond to that location the same, no matter where it is in town, whether it's someplace on the west side or if it's in Cordova Park or Inverness, you're going to get the exact same response.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, you just don't train for response by neighborhood. You train for response by incident type. That's the real key, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Mike, you know, the governor has recently reduced the or made it more available the vaccinations to people 50 years and up who are teachers or are police officers. There was a bit of a halting start to this originally as the cops were getting it, and then I guess you were not getting it. Fire, same thing. You guys now are able. Are the officers vaccinated, all vaccinated, some vaccinated? How's that going?
Some are vaccinated. There were some of us that went and got it the first day that it was available, and I was one of those. And then you have others that have elected not to do it. And it's not just COVID. It was this way with the flu shot, too. I mean, before we're police officers, we're human beings, and we all analyze and think about things such as vaccinations independently. And the city and the police department is not forcing the officers to get the vaccine. So it's totally up to them.
All right. Very good. I know you and I have talked about this many times, but the gun buy program the city of Pensacola is going to vote on final details of tonight. I know it's not a policy that you are implementing, but it is a policy that you are going to be putting into practice. I guess you're not voting for it, but you are implementing, I suppose, a better way to say it. Are you guys already making plans for this? What is this going to look like when people actually come to Bill Gregory Park, assuming that this passes?
Well, they'll bring the weapon with them, and the first thing that we want to do is make sure that weapon is unloaded and safe, and then we will take possession of it, and ultimately that weapon will get destroyed. We hope it's successful, and you'll know if it is or not by the amount of weapons that they get and how much money goes out. Whether that program is ultimately successful or not, that's, again, it's we'll never know. If it gets one or two weapons off the street that could have killed a small child in a home, then yeah, it was worth it. But again, we'll never know the full extent of whether it works or not.
Obviously, yeah. And I know that we're trying to, you know, the whole idea is to reduce violence. But I'll tell you, as a gun owner, I'm the kind of guy that looks at that pile of beautiful guns and thinks, oh, you know, and I think, would there be some collectible item in there? You know, somebody brings in a Tommy gun or something like that. You know, I go, oh no, you have to destroy it. No. One of the other questions that I wanted to ask you about is kind of a cool thing. You've got a new book out on Pensacola police history, right?
Yeah, Sergeant Mike Simmons is a historian. It's an unofficially historian, but he's really good, and he's been studying that department for many years, knows exactly what he's talking about, done a lot of research, and he's got that book for sale. He recently did a book signing at the police department. A lot of good information in there, and even somebody that's been there as long as I have had no idea how old that the police department actually was, and that, you know, the documents and photographs and things like that. So, yeah, it's a good read.
I like it. I'm looking forward to being able to see it. You often have a cop myth for me that we can debunk. There are so many. This is a target-rich environment that you see in movies and TV. You have one for me this week?
Yeah, let's talk about the show CSI, Miami, Los Angeles, New Orleans. In that show, excuse me, it looks as if the crime scene analysts are the detectives, and they run down the case and they make the arrest. And that's just simply not the way it is in larger departments. Now, smaller departments, the patrol officer does everything. He's the patrol officer. He's the crime scene investigator. He's the detective. But most of the time, our crime scene people are just that. They are specialists in that area. They go to crime scenes. They collect and document evidence. They're very good at what they do, and then they forward that information that they have to investigators, and investigators go and investigate that case and ultimately make an arrest. So it's usually in most larger departments, it's two different sections of folks that investigate that crime scene.
So the dashing detective / CSI / prosecutor, the hybrid amalgam of all these different roles in real life, it's the crime scene person over here and the detective over there. Is that right?
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of the crime scene investigators in police departments around the country are civilians, are highly trained civilians. Mm-hmm. The Pensacola Police Department is one of the few that our investigators, our crime scene technicians, are actually sworn police officers.
Hey, you give me another question, and I'm just kind of curious since we're talking about it. The picture on TV is that when a murder happens, that you immediately call the homicide detectives, and the homicide detectives show up at the scene. Does that happen?
Well, we have investigators that are on call, and they do it all. They investigate everything. And, you know, you have some that investigate homicides most of the time, but and gun crimes and property crimes and persons crimes and things like that. But our investigators, they can do it all.
No.
It just sometimes depends on who is end up assigning that case.
No, I mean specifically, like, I know the CSIs come, but do the detectives even go to the site, to the scene?
Yeah. Yes, they do.
Okay. So there's some truth. Hey, we found something TV does right about your job.
Yeah, that's right.
Mike Wood.
But yeah, they're just...
Mike is the public information officer for the Pensacola Police Department. Mike, as always, thank you for the good information. Thanks for the time, and thanks for doing what you do. We appreciate you guys.
Thank you, Andrew.
Absolutely. 549 here on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. I'm Andrew McKay.
Andrew Cuomo, who looks like all three Goodfellas at once, said he hopes to legalize marijuana next month. Cuomo is hoping marijuana will provide New Yorkers a safe, effective way to forget about the nursing home stuff.
Who looks like all three Goodfellas at once? That's so accurate, too.
Florida officials say two women tried to get a second dose of the vaccine by dressing up as grandmothers, which in Florida just means they dressed up as 35-year-olds.
See, there's all this, I don't know, people are worked up about the anti-Israel joke with Saturday Night Live. That's those from last Saturday. Comedy is offensive, or it's not, or you learn how to laugh at stuff. I mean, just, you know, that's my own view. I like a world where there's comedy. I don't like it when jokes are based on falsehoods, particularly, you know, they don't land, but a good joke tells the truth. In a way where you're like, yeah, you got me. 552 here on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Oh, by the way, they followed up. He followed up one more time on the Cuomo stuff.
Researchers studying the remains of a woolly mammoth have uncovered the world's oldest DNA sequence. In fact, it's so old, Andrew Cuomo is covering up its death.
See, they took some opportunities to target the governor, so that's good for them. I hope they do more. I hope they do more. Bipartisanship in your offending is what you should be striving for. Mark Jacobs in the newsroom this morning with our headlines. Mark?
U.S. military carried out an airstrike against a facility belonging to Iranian-backed militia forces in Syria. President Biden approved the strike, which comes after recent rocket attacks against U.S. forces in Iraq. One of those strikes killing a contractor, injuring several Americans. NCAA sets ground rules over potential COVID-19-related withdrawals from next month's men's basketball tournament. Any replacement teams must be named within 48 hours of the bracket's release. They'll assume the exact same bracket position and seating as any team they might replace. And have you heard about this story? Lady Gaga offering a $500,000 reward for the return of her dogs. TMZ says she's offering it, no questions asked. A thief shot her dog walker and then stole two of her French bulldogs Wednesday night in Hollywood. The dog walker is expected to recover. Gaga out of the country at the time.
Look,
it's just bizarre.
It's a crazy story. It's basically, it feels like some El Salvadorian kidnapping and hostage-taking kind of situation that happened right here.
And apparently, it's these particular dogs, French Bulldogs, they're very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
They're like number two on the list of the most popular dog right now.
Okay.
And They can sell from anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 a piece.
Well, that's, that doesn't strike me as all that high compared to how dogs are priced these days,
yeah,
honestly.
It's crazy.
That was one of the things, Mark, thanks for the update. Yeah, and I mean, obviously, it's because they're her dogs, because, you know, she'll pay a mint for them to get them back. You know, you're targeting the dogs of a rich person, which I got to imagine there's a lot of dog walkers, you know, professional dog walkers who are thinking to themselves, maybe it's time to get a concealed carry permit, you know. Here in the great state of California, joke, but no, it's just one of those strange things. But the price of the dogs, we before we got our Australian years ago, was it 4 years ago? How old is she now? I think anyway, we went over to one of the pet stores and we were playing with the dogs and we were looking at a little, because we knew we wanted an Australian and they had an adorable little Australian. It was so much fun, so cute. And we asked them the price, and I wish I could remember the exact number, but I think it was like $4,000. Something just, what in the what? Are you crazy? You know, I mean, we went to a breeder and got her for, I think it was like $700, something like that is what we paid for, which is a reasonable price for a dog. I was like, oh my God, it was either $3,000 or $4,000. I don't remember which. Either way, it was outrageous. But that's not the weird part. The weird part is all the financing, which is common. You know, that's mm-hmm. why they had to have that bill that if you failed to keep your payments up, that they couldn't repossess your dog from you. I mean, it's nuts. And we were in there, and this is kind of the reason I wanted to bring this up is because, you know, we're in there and we're watching people sign to buy car-priced dogs. And it's like, you know, 20-somethings. And we saw a guy who was in the military who was young. I mean, this is not like some, you know, 30-year-old. It's like some 22-year-old in the military who's, you know, off the Navy base. And he's here signing up for this dog. That's the price of a car. I'm like, good Lord. People. You know, this is nuts. 556 here. And now, you know, I'm not saying don't be attached to your dog. I'm just saying that the price that some people are willing to pay and the lengths they go to and the financial decisions, I think Dave Ramsey would not approve. Is kind of the point here. 557 here on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. I'm Andrew McKay. On the COVID front, to post it up on our Facebook page, you want to see it for yourself. But Florida current hospitalizations are now below 4,000 for the first time since November. The peak was 7,700 on January 11th. And although Escambia has now passed 30,000 resident cases, the rate of new cases has dramatically dropped from 319 per day in January to 64 a day. Meanwhile, Santa Rosa has also plummeted tremendously. So we're seeing good news pretty much across the board on the trends. Even though the numbers are still higher than they should be, the direction of those numbers is very good.